Oh, that's right. We're here this afternoon. We are here with Dr. Gus Ramage right here on WCRS. He is one of the partners there at Digestive Diseases. And, you know, when we think about digestive diseases, I think the thing we always think about are colonoscopies. But what you're going to find out this afternoon is there is so much more that goes on over there at Digestive Diseases. So I want to welcome Gus Ramage. How you doing today?
I'm doing great. It's great to be here. Well, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. It's something that nobody really likes to talk about, but it's something that is good to talk about and good to know about some of the other aspects, because sometimes don't you find that people suffer for long periods of time when they could have gotten some help?
Fortunately, people are beginning to realize a great deal more what is available to them. But absolutely, yes, we see people, I have seen people struggle with swallowing problems that were easily fixable, and other bowel problems that they either didn't think there was any help for or just didn't want to talk about.
That's probably one of the biggest issues, isn't it, Dr. Ramage, is talking about it.
Well, it is, because you really have to bring it up with your physician and often, sometimes with your family, to do these things. And we've sort of been conditioned over at least the early parts of our lives not to discuss these matters.
Eventually, you go to the potty by yourself, right?
And that's right.
Exactly.
And you don't announce it to anyone. I have a about to be 3-year old granddaughter. We're working on that with right now.
Exactly. and she's probably quite proud of herself every time she goes.
She's quite proud of herself. Makes the announcement, but we're trying to suppress that, and we carry that right on through into adulthood. So that is something that we do have to deal with a lot, but. But I think one of the striking things when I started here, and I obviously have been in Greenwood for a number of years, but the people who came to me who had struggled with difficulty swallowing for years, and we see them and do a dilation, and all of a sudden they're swallowing well, and it's very remarkable. We don't have that near as much anymore. People are learning.
Well, I think that every time I've heard somebody, and I think particularly with older people, you hear about, I went in and had my esophagus stretched.
Oh,
and,
yes.
And you go, your esophagus stretched?
Mm-hmm.
And yet that is something that is, I guess, more commonplace than we would normally think of.
We do them every day.
Every day.
Every day.
And what happens to the esophagus?
The main thing is gastroesophageal reflux. The acid from the stomach regurgitates into the esophagus. Most of the time, that simply results in heartburn with very little damage to the esophagus. Sometimes it can be a great deal more severe, resulting in either low-grade or even high-grade ulcers in the end of the esophagus. Those ulcers heal, and as they heal, they can narrow the esophagus.
I suppose it's kind of like a scab or something that thickens it?
More, I liken it more to a person, if you've seen a person who's had a burn,
mm-hmm,
and has a contracture from that scar of the burn,
mm-hmm,
ulcers heal with scar, and scar contracts. And in the case of the esophagus, when it contracts circularly.
So you end up with a smaller and smaller space to be
correct,
able to swallow the food.
Correct.
Yeah.
And so we first, you have to address the reason, and that is to say, if there's ulceration there, we reduce the acidity of the stomach, begin to get the ulcer to heal, and then you're able to stretch up the esophagus, and then that maintains rather, once the ulcer is healed, the esophagus maintains rather well, and so it may be years until a treatment is needed again.
Hmm. Well, you know, and so you just, how do you stretch it? Just because I'm curious.
We have mainly two means. The one is a balloon that we can put through the endoscope and inflate to stretch it. That's we can watch that as it happens. It's a little more conservative way to do it. Not quite as effective as the older rubber tubes that we can lubricate and use to stretch the area there. The balloons, the pressure from the balloon may not be adequate to stretch as much as you would like. The others tend to be a little more effective. Both are usually.
Now, I know people that have had this done that have just been amazed at the change mm-hmm. in their ability to swallow and to, I guess, take on more food, right?
which can actually then be a bad thing. then worsen the reflux issues, but among other things. But no, it's good to be able to.
Exactly.
Very good to be able to.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we've got so many different aspects that what we want to talk about. But first, I want to talk a little bit about you. You know, as far as a field, when you were growing up, what were you going to be?
I didn't know for sure. At first, I thought I wanted to be a physicist, and then I thought I wanted to be an engineer, and
you had to have been a basketball player.
As
tall as Gus Ramage is, he has to have been a basketball player. Were you a basketball player?
My excuse is that I wasn't tall enough.
You were tall enough. Well, Gus, how tall are you?
I'm 6'8".
Okay.
But it's not tall enough for me to be a good basketball player.
Okay. All right. But you thought maybe a physicist?
Oh, you know, as a high school and early college student, you have all kinds of ideas, and then I actually trained as a chemical engineer at Clemson, and went to work as a chemical engineer for a couple of years, before realizing that the corporate situation wasn't what was best for me, and also sort of realizing that it was the interaction that I had had with people over the years, my father actually had a service station, and I grew up working there, and I realized a little belatedly that daily interaction with people and helping solve their problems and do things for them was a real motivator for me and something I have enjoyed ever since.
So you went back to school?
Went back to school.
Well.
Yep.
And how did you decide on the field that you're in here?
I went to medical school, finished that, went into internal medicine because it was a complex and challenging field that I liked. Decided on gastroenterology a couple of years into internal medicine because, well, in part, I got... I think everyone has something of that aversion that we talked about with our 3-year-old, mm-hmm. So I just don't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I did an old rigid sigmoidoscopy clinic, and in the process of doing that, I found that doing those procedures wasn't near as distasteful as I thought it was. And after finding 2 or 3 cancers over the course of a month, I realized how incredibly useful and beneficial for people that could be. And it really intrigued me and sort of made me decide to do gastroenterology. As I looked at it more, the other thing about gastroenterology that really appealed to me is that it's not one thing all the time. We do pancreatic disease, we do gallstone and bile duct disease, we do liver disease, we do gastric disease, ulcers, esophageal disease, and of course the colonoscopy, as we hope to get to discuss, colonic disease. So there's a lot to master and a lot to keep you challenged.
Absolutely. Well, we are here with Dr. Gus Ramage. He is with Digestive Diseases. We're going to hear a quick word from our sponsors, then we'll be back. Don't you go away. Hey, if you've got a question for Dr. Ramage, give us a call, 229-7984. That's 229-7984. We'll be right back.
Gold. Gold. More precious than any other time in history. Do you have gold? Do you need cash? Then bring it to SFG. That's Sharp Facets Gallery, 1220 Bypass 72, Greenwood. Telephone 229-6613. Don't forget, we buy diamonds too. Paying the highest prices for your gold and diamonds at Sharp Facets Gallery.
Oh, that's right. We're here with Dr. Gus Ramage. Gosh, we were just talking off the air about, what shall we say, it's not the dark ages, but gosh, it was back in the late 70s, early 80s when you first got into this field. And just when we talk about colonoscopies and what can be done today, we were discussing about how they determined if somebody had colon cancer and how what happened. Yeah. Let's give them the short version.
Well, when I was in medical school in the 70s, this diagnosis was done by X-ray. If someone saw a polyp on X-ray, and you really only saw the large ones mainly, then there was a set of criteria that were used to determine if someone needed to go to surgery to get that out. The idea, even in the late 70s, was that there was no way to just go in there and very simply remove those. That changed very quickly with the development of the and the spread of the fiber optic endoscope. And I was very fortunate to be relatively early in that, not right at the first, but near the beginning.
So really, your industry, as an industry, digestive diseases and all this, has really changed because of the equipment and whatnot that's out there today.
It has changed dramatically over, say, 40 years. Over the past 30 years, the changes have been coming more slowly. Mm-hmm. But still very significant, because we now have video equipment that is much easier to operate, much easier to accomplish what we want to do, and much easier for people to tolerate. We've gotten better with sedation. We've gotten much better with sedation. We've gotten better with many aspects of the procedures.
Sure. And so, you know, when they talk about colon cancer today, they talk about it as one of the most preventable diseases.
That's correct. Colon cancer is the number two cancer killer of Americans, and yet it is it is one of the most preventable cancers, because it tends to grow very slowly. If it can be found either before it becomes actually malignant, or early on in the course of the malignancy, it can be cured very, very frequently. Our goal now is to really prevent the cancer more than to find it, more than to wait for it to occur, and that's accomplished not all the time, but frequently.
Now, what about diet when we talk about digestive diseases? Has there been a change in diet? Is that making some of the differences?
The diet is not making, I don't think, a great deal of difference. Interestingly, many of the things that we attribute to diet it's sort of like many of the things we attribute to nerves. That
or stress.
Or stress.
Yeah, there you go.
What has seemed to me over the years is that as we've begun to understand things more and begun to be able to treat them more effectively, what we've learned that maybe less and less is diet and stress and nerves, and more is things that we can actually do something about.
Okay, all right. And heredity plays a big part. I mean, that's the gene.
Absolutely.
The genes are what is phenomenal, the way they're unwrapping or developing and knowing about this now.
Well, I certainly don't present myself as a genetic expert, and we have many of those. We're blessed with many of those folks here in Greenwood. But genetics certainly plays a part in the development of particularly colon cancer. People who have family members, particularly what we would call a first-degree relative, that is to say a parent or brother or sister or child that who has a colon cancer or colon polyps, is at significantly increased risk over the average population. And yet, the average population by age 50 has significant risk even without a family member.
So is it just age? Is it just part of what American, and it, you know, is this particular to Americans, or are all people subject to it?
Well, that is the answer to that is complicated.
Okay, well,
we'll work on it.
Right.
Undoubtedly, there are factors related to the American diet and the situation of Americans that increases our risk for colon cancer. We see that in groups who move from other countries to America. They actually, their risk of colon cancer becomes, within one generation, the American risk and not the risk of the home country.
Wow.
Which says that it's something about the way they're living and not something about the genes they brought with them. On the other hand, there are clear genetic risk factors. The sequence of genetic changes that occur as a polyp develops into a cancer are well worked out, well understood. Why they occur, how to prevent their occurrence, is not something that we are able to do at this point.
Wow. Well, I know that it's something that people don't like to talk about, but it certainly is something that is a good thing to do for your body.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, we talk about to sort of go into the matter of colon cancer prevention, which I think is one of the things that we would like to have as a take home here. There's basically two approaches. One is to find the cancer early, so that it can be cured early. And the other approach is to try to find the lesions, to find the abnormalities in the colon that will lead to cancer and actually remove those so as to prevent many of the cancers from even forming in the first place. The idea of finding the cancer early is what we do with stool testing for blood. The blood tests in stool, which can be done in a couple of different ways, they've become a little more sophisticated. Those are really directed at finding cancers primarily. They have to be done yearly in order to be effective in doing that, because we want to find the cancer early. And those tests aren't very good at finding the problem before it's an actual cancer.
Hmm. Okay, well, we are here with Dr. Gus Ramage. We're going to be talking about a lot of different aspects of what they do at Digestive Diseases. So why don't you stay right with us? It's time for South Carolina News. We're going to be back, and if you've got a question, give us a call, 229-7984. That's 229-7984. We'll be back after the news.
McDonald's presents Confessions of an Ex-Hipster.
I loved cappuccinos, so I put on an itchy turtleneck and grew a goatee. But before I knew it, I was into French films, indie rock, and not bathing. Luckily, I got help from McDonald's McCafe cappuccinos. Now I'm watching football, wearing khakis, even high-fiving again. Thank you, McDonald's.
New McCafe mochas, lattes, and cappuccinos from McDonald's. With fresh ground espresso and real steamed milk, it's all the coffee, hold the attitude. At participating McDonald's.
Visit your local McDonald's in Greenwood and Abbeville today.
All right, we're back here with Dr. Gus Ramage. He is one of the partners over there at Digestive Diseases. I tell you what, you know, when you start talking about all this stuff, Gus, it really gets, it's a subject we don't want to talk about most of the time, and yet it's a very fascinating topic when you really talk about the strides and the changes that have come about.
Well, that's true. We were beginning to get into the development of colon screening in terms of colonoscopy.
Oh, there you go. You're talking about that word again, Gus.
Yes, we do a lot of that.
You do do a lot of that. And let's talk a little bit about the changes in today's world.
Well, there have been dramatic improvements in both the comfort that we're able to do it in and in the results that we're able to achieve. Undoubtedly, the thing that people dislike the most about colonoscopy is the preparation. And we have, there are increasing numbers of different approaches to the preparation, and also of just different techniques of using the same old ones. We've now learned, for example, if you give half the prep the night before the test and half the prep the morning of the test, that not only do people find it easier to do, they're actually a lot cleaner. When they're a lot cleaner, we see a great deal better. Mm-hmm. One of the issues that we've had with the accuracy of colonoscopy has been some difficulty in seeing abnormalities on the right side of the colon, the furthest part. And that part was not as clean before we learned to change our techniques. So that's been a change only in the past 3 or 4 years that has improved our outcomes a great deal. Also, our ability to sedate people tends to get better and better, so that. Most folks who don't want to remember don't have to. That's not 100%, but it's the vast majority.
So and as far as the flexibleness of it and everything, it's a lot more comfortable.
That's correct. The endoscopes themselves are thinner. They've been able to make them more able to reach the cecum, that is to say, the end of the colon, more able to complete the examination than we were formerly able to do.
So should somebody say, "Oh, that's not something I'm going to do"?
Well, people do that.
Yes, they do.
We really hate for that to happen, and we really work on ways to try to improve it for folks so that they won't feel that way. In general, colonoscopy is just a great deal more comfortable than many people think it will be. Most people who complete it in fact, practically everyone who completes it figures out that the preparation, even though that's not all that pleasant, that was actually the worst part. And so it seems to me, and I've had actually more than one myself. I've had my share. To me, it seems a very small price to pay for a great deal of reassurance about preventing a significant problem.
Absolutely. So now you have the center where you do just all of these.
We do the endoscopic work primarily at the Greenwood Endoscopy Center, which is an ambulatory surgical center, but really only for the performance of gastrointestinal endoscopy, just these procedures, the upper endoscopy and the colonoscopy is what we do there.
So if you'd like more information, now you do have your website where information is available if you'd like to check it out. And there is oodles of information on the web to tell you more about this.
There is. I always caution people in their access to the internet because
it is kind of scary what you can hear. If it's on the internet, it's got to be true, right, Dr. Ramage?
Just like so many other ways of publishing things, that and the internet may be scarier than most, but our site we try to screen to the reliable sources. The Gastroenterology Societies, the American College of Gastroenterology and the American Gastroenterological Association have also very large websites with access to information about almost all of the diseases we treat. And that is very carefully screened, accurate information that is really worth your time. Quite possibly, if you simply Googled a name of a disease, you could get into some pretty scary stuff.
That's true. You know, it is amazing what you can read on the internet. And not only in diseases, but in everything out there.
I say scary, but not only scary, but dangerously inaccurate, potentially.
Exactly. Well, we are here with Dr. Gus Ramage. We are talking about digestive diseases. There are so many. We do want to talk some about ulcers, and we want to talk some about hepatitis C for the baby boomer generation, something you never would have thought that you would have heard about. But I want to ask you, Gus, as medicine is changing here, how do you feel that things are progressing? And as we move forward here, you know, I've heard so many young people being told, don't go into medicine. And that used to be such a time-honored profession.
That is a hard question to answer because the profession is changing really dramatically over the past, really even just the past 5 to 10 years, as more and more physicians are becoming employed. It changes relationships a bit. I don't think that at base it changes the physician's commitment to making people better. That is that's the thing that really makes our profession worthwhile, and makes it worth getting up every morning to go to work and hope you can help some people.
Absolutely. Well, I know one of the things that I know so many doctors are saying is that they're glad they're nearer the end rather than at the beginning of their practice.
And I wouldn't disagree with that in some ways. On the other hand, there really is a great deal of exciting new technology coming along in a number of areas, which we will talk about a couple of them, as you've mentioned. But I think the genetic field, the things that are coming along there, I think many of the things that are being developed in the immunologic fields are the specific treatments for disorders that we've had nothing to offer for. We hear about those, it seems, every day, that there's a new approach that can be taken, a new drug that's available to treat things. And so it's medicine remains very exciting, although doubtless the some of the relationships and some of the employment situations are going to change drastically.
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that I always think when I hear about a new drug that's been developed for something and it's advertised on TV and then they tell you all the side effects on it, it always makes me wonder, should I have the disease or do I want the cure with the drugs that they're handing out?
Well, that's a very valid question to ask, and that's why we need doctors.
Absolutely.
Because we really can't depend on those television advertisements to properly inform us.
Oh, come on now, Gus. I heard about this drug out there, and I want that drug. I bet you get people coming in telling you that.
We certainly do. And oftentimes there's a much less expensive alternative that will work quite well for those folks. Not always.
Sure.
But these wonder drugs have we've been blessed in gastroenterology with treatments in inflammatory bowel disease that have revolutionized our treatment approaches, and yet we had some old treatments much less expensive that work awfully well for folks as well.
Absolutely. We are here with Dr. Gus Ramage. We are going to hear a quick word from our sponsors. When we come back, we're going to be talking about ulcers and hepatitis C. Have you heard about hepatitis C? Well, you got to stay tuned right here on WCRS. We'll be right back.
Gold dust at my feet on the sunny side of...
This year will be a simpler year. One fine gift to last a lifetime from Mother Earth with love. A diamond to light the way and create the energy to keep your love alive. Only at Sharp Facets Gallery, 1220 Bypass 72, Greenwood, 229-6276.
Oh, that's right. We're right back here, Sharp Facets Gallery, this afternoon. Beautiful afternoon, I might add, out there. And we are talking to Dr. Gus Ramage here this afternoon. He is one of the partners over there at the Digestive Diseases. And I certainly hope that everybody is finding this fascinating, as I am finding, to find out more about the things that we can take care of. One of the things that years and years and years ago was the thing on ulcers, and that's part of digestive diseases. How many people out there have ulcers?
Well, fortunately, fewer and fewer as we have learned to treat them more effectively. And I think that's one of the really interesting aspects that has developed over the past few years. Say 20 years ago, it was clearly understood that ulcer disease was related to acid in the stomach, mm-hmm. that it was excessive acid that caused ulcers, and that if one had ulcers and wanted to be rid of them, we had to find a way to get rid of the acid. Then a scientist in Australia noticed that there were bacteria in many of the ulcers, and isolated that bacteria and found that though the bacteria was rather difficult to treat, it could be treated, eliminated, and actually the tendency toward ulcers could be cured in many, many people. And so we've had that whole field has developed so that now That's a routine test that we do. Every biopsy that we take from the stomach is tested for this bacteria, and we can treat people. The vast majority can be effectively treated, and their tendency toward ulcers effectively cured if the bacteria is the reason.
Are there any other reasons?
One of the other big reasons is the arthritis medications.
Arthritis medications?
Yes. The Advil and Aleve that you see so
widely promoted.
So widely promoted. And the BC powders and Goody powders.
Oh, really?
That wonder drug aspirin that that we see widely promoted. All of those drugs have a very strong tendency to cause ulcer disease. That ulcer disease, interestingly, tends to be painless, and may present with bleeding instead of with pain, and so that is actually becoming the majority of ulcer disease that we're seeing now.
So, the only way to not have that is not to be taking those
to minimize their use. Used intermittently and in lower dose, these drugs, they're very effective for arthritis, no question. But in higher doses and used on a daily basis, and particularly used at older age, they have a strong tendency to cause ulcers.
Wow. Okay. Well, there you go. We just learned something else here today. I tell you what, this has been really fascinating for you to come out here. I know you've been very, very busy, and we had to wait a long time, but it's been a great thing to have you here this afternoon. Now we want to talk about baby boomers and hepatitis C. That came out a few months ago.
Only a few months ago, the Centers for Disease Control came out with a recommendation that essentially anyone over 50 should be tested for hepatitis C, and that's because the generation that is that age has a fairly high incidence of hepatitis C for several reasons. One of which is that was the time of the intravenous drugs. Mm-hmm. And people really didn't understand the risks that they entailed back then.
So you're talking about in the 60s there,
We're
I guess.
We're talking about the 60s.
Yes, that's that wild time in life.
It was. And a lot of folks who are now very responsible citizens were...
That wouldn't even ever admit.
That were, right. Were far less responsible with their own health back then.
Yeah.
The other thing was that there was no ability to test for this organism in that time. That developed in the early 90s, actually. And so not only was it that the people, that it was being spread in that group, it was being spread by blood transfusions, because there was no way to test for the virus in the blood. Hepatitis A and B could be tested for, but hepatitis C could not. And so things began to get a great deal safer in the 90s when we began to be able to test for hepatitis C in the blood. Also, of course, able to test for HIV in the blood at about the same time. So blood transfusions became a great deal safer. But people who received blood before about 1986 are at very definitely increased risk and should be tested. Anyone who's ever done recreational drugs definitely needs to be tested. And again, the CDC recommends anyone over age 50 at this time. One of the other reasons for recommending testing at this time is that the treatments are becoming more effective. treatment for this disorder is difficult. There's a lot of symptoms involved, and it's a pretty tough thing to go through. But it seems like every few years now, we are getting more effective treatments and able to cure a larger percentage of the folks who have the disease, and to prevent cirrhosis of the liver by doing so.
And that is what happens with hepatitis C, is that correct?
In a substantial percent of people who have it. Not everyone.
Okay.
Probably about 25% of people who have hepatitis C will develop end-stage disease from it.
Wow. So, and what type of cure is there? I mean, what type of, how do they treat it?
The drugs are basically the current cocktail is a pill that is taken three times, that's taken really every 8 hours. It has to be taken extremely regularly every 8 hours. There's another pill called ribavirin that has to be taken twice daily, and there's an injection called interferon that has to be given every week. Each of these things has significant side effects, and people get significantly anemic, they get flu-like reactions and such. So it's not that easy. On the other hand, we're treating a serious disease and can do so effectively. One of the other good things is that we're seeing improved treatments come out every few years, and there is on the horizon now even more effective therapy.
Absolutely. Well, Dr. Gus Ramage, you have been right here on WCRS right here in Greenwood. We certainly appreciate you coming out here today. Thanks so much.
I really thank you for having me. I've enjoyed it very much.
All right. Thank you so much. That's going to do it for us. This is WCRS right here in Greenwood. Bye-bye, everybody.